Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. From the latest execution in South Dakota to the state legislature's efforts to hold the South Dakota Department of Education accountable for improving student test scores, the Dakota political junkies have much to discuss today. Today we welcome Michael Card. He's Associate Professor of Political Science from the University of South Dakota, and he's joining us from SDPB's Vermilion Studio. Mike Card, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for the invitation, Lori. I'm pleased to be here.
And joining us from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation Studio at Northern State University in Aberdeen, we welcome John Schaff, Professor of Political Science at Northern. And welcome to you as well, John.
Thanks for having me. It's dangerous having two political scientists on, Laura. You might not get any words in over the next 25 minutes or so.
We gave you extra time, and I have a nice cup of hot chocolate here to sit back in the snow.
You planned well.
And let her rip. All right, let's start with farm bankruptcies because they are on the rise. Not quite as bad as the 1980s, but significant. John Schaff, kick us off.
Yeah, I think this is... explains there's so much anxiety in the ag field these days, and the ag part of our economy these days. And I was looking at recently soybean prices, just trying to figure out what does the market think of where things are going with trade, and the best way thing to do is to go look at, well, what's the market say? This tells us what's going to happen with trade. Is the market optimistic or not? And I detected some slight optimism because bean prices were slightly up. But when you compare bean prices to, say, 18 months ago and 24 months ago, and there's really no comparison. The prices are so low. The American farmer is in some way is a victim of his own success, is that we get such great yield. We're so productive. And the way that we keep our farm economy going is by giving new markets to our farmers. We're great on supply. What we need is to increase demand, and we do that through markets. And when you cut the biggest part of the biggest market in the world out in China, ag is really, really going to hurt. And so we see things that something like 40% of farm economy this year is going to be transfer payments, insurance payments, these kind of extra payments that the Trump administration has come up with to take into account some of the malign effects of trade policy, and so you feel that we hear over and over that a trade agreement is coming. I think for our farm economy, it can't happen soon enough.
Hmm. Professor Card, where does the political blame for that land? Does it?
Well, I think you have to go back many places, and one of which is the tariffs that our president has placed on trade with China is part of what has reduced the demand. I think the other part that we have to deal with is that China has made promises that they haven't been willing to live up to, all the way from joining the World Trade Organization, even to their promises to buy more soybeans. They simply haven't bought them. And now they're looking elsewhere in other markets, which we've seen recent activity in South Dakota with the Soybean Growers Association to look for other markets, because that by sourcing their soybeans elsewhere, China is probably going to stay there with that new market that they've uncovered for buying soybeans. So our soybean farmers and those in the corn and soybean states have to go out and find new markets, and it's not clear that how much the federal government is helping them. We have a legislator in South Dakota that brought some Egyptians to the state to try to find a new market. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lot of it. But John also mentioned, and we need to reiterate, it's a victim of our own productivity. Our farmers are producing food to feed the world. Unfortunately, not all of the world either can or is willing to buy our soybeans.
Well, you can't vote against China, but you can cast a vote against a president. You can cast a vote for a state lawmaker or against one. You can cast a vote for your congressional delegation. John Schaff, do you think, as those numbers rise, as we see the bankruptcies surging to 24%, largely focusing on the Midwestern area, that it has political implications in 2020?
Yeah, I was thinking about South Dakota specific implications, and I think back to 1986 when Tom Daschle defeated Jim Abner. Jim Abner, of course, was the incumbent U.S. Senator, and Tom Daschle was a member of the House of Representatives at the time, which, granted, is a pretty strong position to run for Senate from, especially in the state of South Dakota. But nonetheless, farms, the farm policy was a big reason why Tom Daschle could unseat Jim Abner. And when Ronald Reagan came to the state late in that campaign, it's not clear whether Ronald Reagan coming to South Dakota to campaign for Jim Abner was a benefit or a harm, because the farmers were so angry at the Reagan administration. And when you see things like when the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, was in Wisconsin, was like a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, and he was talking about dairy farming, but nonetheless, when he used the phrase, farmers got to get big or get out. Yeah. That's not what our farmers want to hear. And that sounds exactly like what in the past has gotten farmers angry in the 1980s. It's what one of the things that helped George McGovern rise in the 1950s is Eisenhower administration officials saying nearly the exact same thing. And you wonder if there isn't an opportunity, if the Democrats can field credible candidates as Republicans who feel beholden to the Trump administration and to tout themselves as more Trumpist than thou, if that can't be used in some circles against them. But that there's a variable I mentioned there, that's the Democrats fielding credible candidates, and that's something that
the party has struggled to do. Before the Democrats who are listening get too excited, I'm not hearing from any of the Democrats presidentially a whole lot about the farm economy. Of course, I haven't been following as closely yet. But Mike Card, does that leave an opportunity for people like Dan Ahlers or Skylar Borglum, some of the South Dakota candidates who are running for office, to lean heavy on what they're saying about the farm economy and how they would represent South Dakota and Washington?
Well, it certainly provides a little bit of an opportunity. South Dakota is sufficiently Republican by registration that our elected representatives can distance themselves from the president. Jim Abner in 1986 was damaged by the primary battle with Bill Janklow. Mm-hmm. And that certainly made the race much closer than it would have been otherwise. I guess that's my opinion. But I think most scholars of that study would say that's true. And that meant that Abner, who was a good, loyal Republican and followed the president, and he might have followed him right into defeat. Mm-hmm. Again, what John mentioned was is that the Democrats had a credible candidate. And we've got some candidates who are opposing our incumbent senator and incumbent representative in Congress. But I think there's sufficient room that that our incumbents can distance themselves from the president.
Let's pivot a little bit and talk about the news of the week, which was including the execution of Charles Russell Rhines for a 1993 murder. And John Schaff, tell us a little bit about why this is politically significant in the state of South Dakota right now.
Well, I think what we get to different subjects later on. We talk about medical marijuana or marijuana in general legalization. I think capital punishment, maybe like that issue, is a place where South Dakota maybe is bucking certain national trends. 20 years ago, something like 37, 38 states had capital punishment. Since that time, about 11 or 12 of them have gotten rid of capital punishment. And there's two reasons for that, I think. One is the rise of DNA evidence indicated that there were at least a sufficient number of people on death row who were actually not guilty of the crime that they committed, that it made certain states nervous. I think Illinois was one of those states where they were too nervous about the idea that they could be executing and maybe in the past had executed people who are not guilty of the crime they were convicted of. And so some states have gotten rid of the death penalty. Another thing that's happening, which I think was relevant to this case with Charles Rhines, is because United States is an outlier in the world, certainly in the industrial world, for still having capital punishment. And still most of our states, I think it's 28 or 29 states, have capital punishment. But most Western states, industrial states, do not. And many of the drugs that are used to put people to death come from overseas, and those nations are refusing to sell these drugs to the United States. And so states are being forced to use what you might call second best drugs to execute people. And that was part of the Rhines team's brief to the Supreme Court, was about what is the nature of the drug being used to administer the capital punishment. Now, of course, they lost that appeal, or just, you know, it was denied by the Supreme Court, by Justice Gorsuch. But I think it's an indication of, you know, is South Dakota going to continue with this thing where it might be that, at least to a certain extent, the tide is going a little bit in the other way, both nationally and certainly internationally.
Mm. And Mike Card, we had Sister Helen Prejean on the program not too long ago, a vocal opponent of capital punishment. And one of the things she said when I asked her about our then upcoming execution was, you know, you need a governor who, you know, is willing to stand out against capital punishment. You need an attorney general. You need attorneys, public opinion. There's all kinds of things that can sort of quickly eliminate a state relying on capital punishment at all. Mike Card, do you see that did we see any indications from Governor Kristi Noem or any of those factors in South Dakota that show the state might be reconsidering its stance for future cases?
I haven't seen anything from Governor Noem that would indicate that she is moving anywhere on capital punishment. I think there's more of a movement elsewhere in the state, especially when we look at South Dakota incarcerates more people per capita than most states do. We also, you know, going in the other direction, the people that we've executed, it's hard to have sympathy or empathy towards them. But when we're looking at capital punishment as a person's character, a reason to execute someone or not, I think the criteria aren't at the right place. It's the argument center around, is it right for the state to execute someone? It's the legal form of killing. And I suspect that the movement is away, as John suggested, but again, with the inmates who, we only have one left on death row, they're not exactly outstanding citizens.
These cases, Donovan Schaefer's family, and he was killed by Charles Russell Rhines, said, you know, this is justice. And there was no question that Charles Rhines was guilty of the crime. It occurs to me that some families are, you know, making, as, you know, John Chaff was saying, as the tide turns and people are thinking in different ways about capital punishment, that the family has a large voice in this. John Chaff, the family of the victims, I mean, is that putting a pretty big responsibility on the family of a victim to sort of speak out one way or the other after such a tremendous loss?
Well, I think, you know, Michael hit on something when he said it's almost inevitable in capital cases that the accused, I chose my words carefully. I said there, sometimes we have found people who are innocent of the crime with which they've been convicted, which doesn't mean they're innocent of other crimes. Usually people who end up on, not always, but usually people who end up on death row in almost all cases are pretty nefarious characters. And so I think what happens is it's a question of, you know, when after the fact, when the family of the deceased, you know, can they strike? Because, you know, it's easy to put the deceased, the convicted who's now been put to death, to put them in a very negative public light for obvious reasons, because they've been convicted of murder, and they're as Michael says, not really sympathetic characters. But then, you know, in most cases, it seems that the families are there, that they find this, I don't know if they want to call it cathartic. Or certainly in this case, it seems like they, as you said, that justice is being done. And I think that sort of mitigates any movement against the death penalty when, you know, obviously one of the arguments for the death penalty is that this is what justice demands. And no one can speak to that more powerfully, more emotionally than the family of the person who was murdered, you know, that deceased person was the one that obviously society is most concerned about. It's just, I think, a question of whether we can, as we put people to death, whether we can do that in a humane fashion, whether we can, you know, what is, you know, Michael talks about how many people we have incarcerated in the state. That is a huge cost, but it's actually, in most cases, it's cheaper to incarcerate someone for life than to execute them, just because the mandatory appeals in death penalty cases make it so expensive, because, you know, that's just the attorney fees and the legal fees and the time involved with all these appeals is extremely time consuming and expensive. It's typically more expensive to put them to death. Is there a way that we could save money by incarcerating people? I mean, these are all the issues that we have to think about as we consider what our position should be on capital punishment.
And we have another interesting issue with that, and that is it's the state of South Dakota versus a person, not a person against a person. This isn't a civil trial.
Yeah.
These are the state, in terms of keeping order and providing for public safety, should be determining what the penalty is. And it's an open question, I think, for us to consider, is whether we give an outsized voice to the victims.
But certainly,
it's an emotional and powerful issue. I am not in that position, so I can't speak for those who are in that position.
And we will take a break. And before we do that, you know, the family made it very clear that every conversation about this case really should be about Donovan. So as a reminder, Donovan Schaefer was about to graduate from Western Dakota Tech when he was killed. He was an award-winning state champion archer, and he loved hunting and fishing. And I understand he drove a red truck. So we remember Donovan today. We'll have more with Dakota Political Junkies after a break on listener-supported SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're talking this hour with Dakota Political Junkies John Schaff and Mike Card, two political science professors. Mike Card is joining us from the SDPB studios in Vermilion, as he's with the University of South Dakota. John Schaff is joining us from the Tom and Danielle Ammon Foundation studio, as he is with Northern State University in Aberdeen. And I'd like to start this segment by talking about the South Dakota Department of Education and a rather unusual, but I'm not sure if it's unprecedented, move from the oversight panel to say not good enough for South Dakota students with the budget that you have. Mike Card, start us off with how exactly this unfolded.
Well, I think the first part of this is to recognize that the legislature has oversight activities over the institutions of government in South Dakota. They certainly fund the Department of Education and give authorization for the Department of Education to spend money. So as part of that, the legislature has hired a program evaluator or two. I believe it's just one, but I'm not sure. And they have set forward expectations for the agencies to develop a plan to improve over time. And as a result of that, every agency has to report to the Government Operations and Audit Committee every 3 years, I believe. And as a result, the Department of Education is one of the agencies that was reporting this year. And the Government Operations and Audit Committee, or GOAC as they're called, noted that they've received about $200 million in authority to expend money, and their oversight is that the self-reported statistics regarding student performance and the quality of their education isn't increasing, and that's the proficiency rate standard. So they're taking an active step in assisting with oversight and wanting a plan to move forward and to move these proficiency rates higher. And at the same time, in South Dakota, local government is a special district called a school district, and they make most of the curricular decisions regarding education and how they're taught and evaluate the teachers and hire the teachers. So it's sort of the department is caught in the middle by providing technical assistance, but they don't actually deliver the education to the children of our state.
Mm. So for reference, according to an email from Chris Carr, who's on the committee, the English proficiency rate for third graders has been between 48% and 51%, with a five-year goal of 54%. The math proficiency rate for eighth graders has been between 39% to 47%, with a five-year goal of 52%. That's just a little bit from the validation or the argument to say we can do a lot better. John Schaff, talk about Ben Jones's kind of role in this, because when he came to the program here talking about the latest report, you know, he fully admitted openly, like, there's a gap and we've got to do something about it.
Yeah, I think it's I feel for Dr. Jones, because it seems like he's been caught holding a stinky mess that somebody else created, so to speak. Because obviously he's been our Secretary of Education for, he was interim and then full time. So he's been in the position for, let's say, about a year and a half, almost 2 years here. But these are trends that have been occurring over a period of time. And as Secretary Jones mentioned in his testimony before the GOAC committee, is that one of the things that has happened is that over the last handful of years, we've had a change in how we test students and assess proficiency. As we went from, you might say, the No Child Left Behind years to the Common Core years, in the Obama years, one of the things that happened is that we changed the test that we use from the STEP test to the Smarter Balance test. And one of the things that Secretary Jones notes is that if we would have stayed with the STEP test, maybe we would have seen different rates of proficiency, because one of the things that's going on is we've had to kind of reset what does it mean to be proficient as we've moved from one test to another. And it's also, if we're talking about testing and we've got these five-year goals, if today we decide we want our proficiency rate in English amongst third graders to be this percentage, well, that's not going to happen next year. This is something that it takes a number of years to change curriculum, to change pedagogy, and then to see the results of that change. And
Can I jump in real quick, John?
Sure.
Because what I'm wondering is, those tests are very different as a parent of a child in the school system. Like, we all know that, how those are, they're starkly different. Is it the testing? Was the proficiency always that low and it just seemed like it was higher because we had a different test? Is this a flawed testing? What I'm getting at is how bad are the students actually and how bad is the testing material?
Well, one of the claims that some people have made is that the Smarter Balance test, the question is which of the tests are valid. And it's possible that neither are valid.
Right.
But there have been concerns, especially I would say like in mathematics, that the test simply wasn't a valid test, and these things are put together by committees. There's been, especially in mathematics education, there's been a revolution between what STEP was doing, what Smarter Balance is doing, the way Common Core envisioned mathematics. There was a revolution in how they envisioned mathematics education and whether that test is actually getting at what the students know. And in that sense, is it a valid test? And I've heard multiple people and people I trust on these matters, especially in mathematics, that the shift in the testing was inevitable because people really people didn't really know what it meant to be proficient. So you have to run the test a few times to figure out, well, what can students do on this? What does it mean to be proficient? Because we've changed the testing regime. And to a certain degree, when these tests are put together, they're put together by a committee, and they're sort of like throwing darts at a board. And I wouldn't be so sure that just because, and I believe in testing to a certain extent, but I wouldn't be so sure just because the percentages on people changing tests is different that students aren't learning what we want them to. But the big bugbear in education is always that it is extremely difficult to assess what we're doing because there are so many variables that go into student learning. And Michael and I are both in education, granted at a higher education level, but it's always a struggle to figure out what is the best method, what is a valid measure of our students are doing what we want them to do. And it's extremely difficult to get a measure that is valid and pleases everybody.
Say big bugaboo again.
Bugaboo.
Thank you. Yep. Mike Card, your thoughts on, as far as, here's my question, where do we go from here? What's next, for Secretary Ben Jones, for teachers, for parents, like how, for the legislature, like where do we get, is everybody's going to get spun up about this? Calm down, take a deep breath, and figure out where do we go from here?
Right. I think that's the real challenge. And as John mentioned, we've changed the curriculum, and then the question becomes, have we given the curriculum enough time that we can adequately test what was taught and what was learned? And then is the other question of validity is this what is more likely to be needed for someone to progress in the next 50 years? Because as they graduate from high school and go to work or attend a technical school and take a technical trade or attend higher education and move forward with their lives, whatever that means, what is it that they need to know? And that has changed over the past 10 years. That was the institution of the Common Core, was at least one method of looking across the states as to what was needed for our youth to move forward with their lives as a basic core knowledge. But again, we need to take a deep breath and partly see how this plays out. We don't really want to test both at the same time to see, well, is it a testing effect? Well, we could determine that by if we gave the Smarter Balanced assessment as well as the No Child Left Behind assessment. but I don't think we want to spend more days testing.
Yes. Take that back.
We want to spend more time teaching and learning.
Yes. All right. And as Ben Jones is finding out, what is the least disruptive way to make some of those changes? Because some of the things that he said he'd like to do, probably aren't, the way to move forward because of the massive amounts of disruption. We're going to be talking about this for a long time to come, so I want to say thanks to Professor John Schaff and Professor Mike Card for being our Dakota Political Junkies for the day. John, thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Mike, thanks too.
I'm pleased to be here, and I wish everyone a wonderful day.